This is Northwest News from 88.5 KPLU. I'm Ed Ronco. Practice rounds begin today for the U.S. Open at Chambers Bay in University Place. In 120 years, this is the first time golf's championship event has visited the Pacific Northwest. Mike Trosel is the U.S. Golf Association's historian, and he joins us now. Mike, the U.S. Open history in general goes back a long way.
In 1895, Horace Rollins was our winner. There were just 11 entries in the 1895 U.S. Open. They played in Newport.
In Newport, Rhode Island.
In Newport, Rhode Island. Exactly right. They went around a nine-hole course four times, and Horace Rollins was the winner. This year at Chambers Bay, there were almost 10,000 entries to get down to our field of 156.
How do you go from 10,000 to 156?
It's a long process. There's local qualifying, 18 holes, and then sectional qualifying, and you're talking hundreds of qualifying sites to get down to our field of 156. And, you know, in that field of 156, we have a 15-year-old amateur who's playing, and we have several past U.S. Open champions.
This is the first time in the Pacific Northwest for the U.S. Open. Why hasn't it been here before? It's interesting to me.
You know, it took us a while. It took the USGA a while to actually come all the way out west. First U.S. Open, 1895. The first time we came out to the west coast of the Pacific Ocean was 1948.
Wow.
Played at Riviera, just outside of Los Angeles. So it, you know, golf for a long time in the United States was mainly based on the East Coast and then the Midwest corridor. But once we got out to the West Coast, there's been some great championships out here. Hogan winning in 48. Pebble Beach has had a ton of them. Mm-hmm. Nicklaus in 72. Tom Watson chipping in 1982. Tiger Woods winning by 15 in 2000. The closest we've come to the Pacific Northwest before was San Francisco. We've played at the Olympic Club. It's a championship that does belong to the whole country, so we knew we needed to come to the Northwest. And I don't think it speaks anything poorly about the golf courses up here or the passion of the fans. It's a great sports base up here.
As people are watching this on television or maybe in person, what should they look for?
The great thing about the U.S. Open is the democratic nature of it. Anyone who has the skill and the passion can go out and win this championship. And that's kind of cool when you think about it. And I think as people are going through the channels, not only is it going to be beautiful on TV, we're just looking at Chambers Bay and the Puget Sound in the background, but to watch these players navigate, there are so many factors at play. It's physical factors, certainly. It's a tough walk. I've walked the course, and it's not easy. But the mental factors and the strategy that goes into it, it's a little bit of raw athleticism, like a football or a basketball, but it's also some strategy. There's some chess involved, if you will. And I think the combination of those two things is really what makes golf pretty special to watch, and hopefully what will make for another great championship at Chambers Bay.
Well, these golfers are playing against each other. They're also playing against the course.
That's absolutely true. And you're playing against Mother Nature. We certainly, you know, the weather up here, it could be very windy. It could be rainy. Or, you know, in the past week, it's been 85 degrees, too, so you don't really know what you're going to get.
There are some life metaphors in that, aren't there? That golf is this game about constant improvement and constant variables, and it is not the same defined field every day. Things change all the time.
You can learn a lot about someone from playing around to golf with them, their personality. You know, there's no better way to learn about someone and, you know, their honesty and their integrity, I think, at some extent, but their personality. You know, you need to have these certain skills, the perseverance and competitive spirit out there, the vision out in the golf course.
Maybe a little humor and diplomacy, too.
You need to. You can't take yourself too seriously out there. You know, everyone's going to hit some bad shots, especially those of us who aren't playing in the U.S. Open at Chambers Bay this week. But it's fun. And every once in a while, you know, you'll hit a shot or two that, you know, is as good or maybe, you know, approaches something that a Rory or a Jordan Spieth or Ricky Fowler can do out there. And that's what brings you back. That's what hooks you in. You make a par, you make a birdie, you make a 40-foot putt. And you say, this is pretty cool. I think I can do this. And it's a game that's challenging, but it can be rewarding. And I think the reason that I like it so much is that it's not easy.
Golf, I think, can feel inaccessible to people sometimes. How do groups like the USGA make golf more accessible?
You know, we know the two biggest factors that hold people back from playing golf our time and money. So we're trying to either, you know, improve the pace of play and make it more cost effective for people to get out there and really enjoy the game. You know, people don't want to get beat up every time they go to the golf course. They want to have something that's fun and quick. And we know there's so many other things that are taking up your time, whether it's taking your kids to swim practice or soccer practice or music lessons or whatever it is. Uh-huh. I mean, that happens. That's a reality of life and where we are. So the 5-hour round, the 6-hour round is not something that most families can do anymore. So we're trying to make sure, hey, if you can just go out and play nine, that's another initiative, our Play Nine initiative. Just get out there for a little bit. Can you play three or four holes after work just to play a little golf and get away and get outside and walk and get some fresh air? And that's some of the ways we've tried to make the game a little more accessible.
Not having to commit to all 18 holes or just being able to golf as much as you want to golf.
Exactly.
Do you golf?
I do.
And how'd you get into it?
I got into it, believe it or not, through my mother and my grandmother. My dad wasn't much of a player, but my grandmother, my mom was the youngest of 10, and my grandmother loved to watch golf on TV, and it was right around the era where Arnold Palmer was beginning to play, and Arnold did so much to grow the game of golf. You know, my grandmother would watch Arnold playing, and my mom would sit in her lap and watch it. So then when she got older and had me, you know, she'd be watching golf, and I saw that, and all of a sudden got a little set of starter clubs and chipped and made all sorts of divots in the backyard that I'm sure drove my dad crazy as he's trying to mow the lawn. And then I played a little bit at school and was a history major, so it was kind of a natural transition to be the historian at the USGA, and it's really a dream job for me.
You know, when you look back now knowing the history of golf and what the game means now and what the game meant then, why is it special to you?
I think it's the cultural aspect of it. You know, what we try and do in the museum is take you through golf in America, but through the lens of what was happening in society. You know, golf's not happening in a vacuum, so you can look at what other factors had an influence on it, whether it's political factors, cultural factors, economic factors, social factors, and how those influenced the game of golf. During the Great Depression, how the game shrunk a little bit, how country clubs were closing, and how during the boom era, the baby boomers in the 1940s and 50s, and Dwight Eisenhower playing golf, how the game really grew exponentially, and under Tiger Woods, how the game really grew again around 2000. You know, I love to see it set in context. And I also really like to see the popular culture aspect of it, too. My favorite artifact, and that's a question I get a lot, what's your favorite artifact in the museum? And the one I always say is something called a Moon Club. It's a club used by Commander Alan Shepard on the Apollo 14 mission that went up. And Shepard is a big golfer. So down in Houston, where NASA is, he took a Wilson Staff 6-iron head, and he brought it up with him in a sock and two golf balls. And he had an instrument used for collecting lunar rock samples that if you put it all together, it was detachable. But if you put it all together, it was about the length of a 6-iron. So he was able to fashion the 6-iron head to the end, had the two golf balls. And when he went up on the moon, he actually hit some golf balls with that 6-iron club.
I wonder if someday in the not too distant or maybe very distant future, we might retrieve the golf ball and put it in the museum.
You know, it's funny. Shepard went to his grave not telling anyone what brand of golf ball it was. He didn't want any single brand, whether it was Titleist or Top Flight or Slazenger or Tourney, McGregor, to benefit from it and say, you know, the only golf ball used in the moon. He just said, I love golf. I want to hit a couple of shots, but I don't want anyone to profit from this. I just want the game of golf, really, to be the one that profits from this.
Didn't want it to become like the Tang of golf balls.
Exactly right.
Mike Trosel, USGA historian, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.